I'm with Shashi Tharoor, the Congress Member of Parliament from Thiruvananthapuram in Kerala, a former international diplomat, a public intellectual, a novelist, several books, both fiction and non-fiction to his credit, including on colonialism and an inglorious empire. And I will get to that in a very quick minute, dear viewer. But first, let me welcome Mr. Tharoor to the print. Mr. Tharoor, wonderful to have you.
Thank you. Good to be with you again.
Yeah. Okay. So my first question to you is about the current controversy over the moving, if you like, or the merging of the Amar Jawan Jyoti to the National War Memorial. Several people have said, including the Minister for Urban Development, Mr. Hardeep Singh Puri, that the India Gate is a colonial monument, implying that India is embarrassed or ashamed of its colonial past. You've written a lot on this subject. Your first comments on this controversy.
Thank you. By that logic, Rashtrapati Bhavan is a colonial monument. I mean, let's be serious. After independence, these became ours and we use them for our own purposes. India Gate was very much a popular spot in Delhi for Indians, many of whom had no idea of its association with the colonial wars. But the most important thing was the Amar Jawan Jyoti, which was actually put in 1972 after the Bangladesh War, and which has been burning uninterrupted for 50 years. So to extinguish something which has been burning in honor of the valiant Indian soldiers who fought both in 71, 72 and before and after seemed to me a great travesty. The government could easily have had a separate flame or a separate other way of honoring more recent or whoever they want to honor elsewhere. But why rub out something which has been sanctified by 50 years of respect and honoring and ceremonies? We've all been to ceremonies at the Amar Jawan Jyoti. I certainly have. And I often used to go there even on other occasions like the Kargil Vijay Diwas just to pay my respects. And it was the kind of thing one did. And so 50 years of associations, 50 years of very post-colonial respect and honoring of that flame is just being wiped out with a careless wave of the hand. And I think that the reason the government is so willing to snuff these things out is they're engaged in this desperate exercise and reinvention. There is this entire conviction on the part of Mr. Modi and his cohort that history began in 2014, that everything that happened from 1947 to 2014 was merely a prelude to their greatness and was so unimportant that it can be pushed aside. Whether it's rebuilding parliament, whether it's reinventing the central vista, or whether it's removing the Amar Jawan Jyoti, it's like anything that happened before Mr. Modi's era is not worth preserving. And that, I think, is fundamentally wrong.
Okay, Mr. Tharoor, now a couple of questions from there. On the Amar Jawan Jyoti, Admiral Arun Prakash, former naval chief, has written in the Indian Express saying, and General Dipender Hooda, he commanded the 14th Corps in May, has said that this is unnecessarily becoming a political issue, that there was always, that the Indian soldier always felt that there was something wrong having the eternal flame under the India Gate or the arch of the India Gate, saying, and Admiral Arun Prakash has said very clearly that that the Indian soldier felt that it would be much better if it was at a national war memorial and not under a colonial monument. What do you make of that?
Well, in that colonial monument, whose deaths are commemorated, 90% of the names there are of Indian names. You know, the fact is our soldiers fought in colonial wars, whether we like it or not. There was an undeniable aspect of our history. And from what I know of the army regiments prize their entire history. They don't think history even began in 47. Many of them are proud of battles that their regiments have fought in the 1700s and 1800s. So it's difficult for us to sit around today and completely wipe out all that history. It's part of who we are. I have no problem with, I mean, I actually called for a national war memorial. I'm probably the first Congress MP to so do because I went to Canberra and was so impressed with the war memorial there. And I thought, my gosh, our soldiers have done so much more fighting than the Australians have, and we don't have anything like this. And I came back and called for it. I raised it in the government. And I also, I must say, tweeted about it and wrote about it. But the fact is that when it happened, I openly supported the government's decision, even though it was the BJP government's decision.
The Narendra Modi government's decision in 2014, you supported the Narendra Modi government.
I did. You know, we find it on the record. So I am not criticizing the National War Memorial. I wanted one. I'm proud of it. I'm happy to pay tribute there. I'm just saying, to create something new, you don't have to necessarily destroy something old. Mm-hmm. And what's shameful, it seems to me, is the travesty of tarnishing the 50-year history of the Amar Jawan Jyoti by associating it purely with...
But can you have two flames, Mr. Tharoor? Is it, you know...
No.
Can we have two flames, two eternal flames? That's a bit odd, isn't it?
No, if it's eternal, it should last forever, shouldn't it? It's only the starting date that's different. The flames can last, and they're, you know, just as we have so many different kinds of graceful monuments across the country for similar purposes, we can't just say that this doesn't matter. I mean, there are war memorials, as you know, for the Second World War in places like Imphal. Are we going to say that should be shut down because we built one in Delhi?
So let's talk a little bit about this ambivalent, sort of views that we have about our own history. I mean, you just said that India participated in thousands in both the First World War as well as in the Second World War. India was not an independent country.
Many colonial wars before that. In fact, from the days of the East India Company, the British expanded their presence right around the world on the backs of Indian soldiers and at the point to the bayonet of Indian soldiers. So we are very much a part of their history. The British Empire would not have existed without Indian soldiers. Whether it's in Aden, whether it's in Hong Kong, whether it's in Singapore, Indian soldiers were everywhere.
So that's the point, Mr. Tharoor. If the British Empire was built or expanded on the back of the Indian soldier across the world, then surely we should be ashamed of something like that, rather than collude in maintaining its memory.
You know, we can face our history, and, you know, I've tried to do so in the book you referred to already, An Era of Darkness or Inglorious Empire, two titles for the same book, in which I've actually talked about this. I've given exact numbers for all our soldiers in all these places. But the fact nonetheless is they are Indian soldiers. They risk their lives. 1.3 million Indian soldiers served in World War I. 74,000 of them lost their lives. Another 75,000 were severely injured. Do we today look back and say those sacrifices meant nothing? After all, it's Indian blood that's flowed into these foreign fields. And I must say, in many ways, the fact that they were upholding the flag of a colonial empire matters to me less than the fact that they were Indians risking their lives abroad. And of course, in both cases, they did fight for democracy and decency against tyranny and dictatorship. So that wasn't too bad either, because at the end of the day, if the Indian soldiers hadn't been there, and in both cases, the Allies had lost, we might be living in a much more unpleasant world, and perhaps a world in which we would not be terribly happy. So counterfactuals at the end of the day are really an academic exercise. What happened, happened. We had this enormous amount of sacrifice and heroism by Indian soldiers. Their stories have long been omitted from popular histories of the war. And I can tell you why. It's because at the end of the war, India felt they gained nothing from these sacrifices. The British betrayed their promises to give us more self-governance, even dominion status, as had been reserved hitherto for the white Commonwealth countries like Australia, New Zealand, Canada, South Africa. And because of that, I think many of our nationalists felt, you know, these sacrifices weren't for us. These guys were going for their salary, for their jobs. So we ignore them. And in fact, I remember I was a child during the 50th anniversary of the First World War. There was practically no commemoration in India.
So this was 1964, just before the 1964.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, why would the rest of the world commemorate our soldiers? They celebrated their own. And all these Indian lives went unmourned and the Indian heroism unsung. And to me, I thought, wait a minute, there's something wrong with this picture. So I began around the time of 2014, as the centenary was nearing, I started writing about this. And I wrote in the Indian papers and I wrote in the international press about the sacrifices of the Indians. I got a lot of encouragement from some soldiers, retired officers and so on, who are working in documenting the efforts of the Indian soldiers. And I'm very proud of what they've done. I mean, it was Indian soldiers who stopped the German advance at Ypres in the autumn of 1914, soon after the war broke out, while the British were still recruiting and training their own forces. And without the Indians, who knows, the Germans might have won the war in a matter of months. And these Indian soldiers, by the way, they were actually on ship heading towards Cairo. They had summer clothes, they had warm weather clothes for serving in Egypt, when suddenly they were diverted to France because war was breaking out in Europe. Mm-hmm. And these chefs really did amazing stuff, and hundreds of them were killed, another set of hundreds in a gallant but futile engagement at the Battle of Neuve Chapelle. Another 1,000 of them a little later next day died in Gallipoli, where Churchill had foolishly had ordered an attack. Then you had Indian sepoys fighting in Mesopotamia, that is Iraq and Syria today, against the Ottoman Empire, which is Germany's ally there, which was Germany's ally. So all of these things were extraordinary parts of the military history of India, and the regiments that sent these soldiers, they honor these people, they commemorate them. Why shouldn't we, the civilians, also honor their memory?
So two questions to that, Mr. Tharoor. You know, you talked about 1964, which was the 50th anniversary of when the First World War began and how there was absolutely nothing in India. But 64 is when the Congress Party is very much in power, your own party. Now, obviously, I'm not going to blame you for what your sort of, you know, your four... No, but the question is, in independent India, you know, how did the Congress Party, or how does India look upon these millions of soldiers? You said 74,000 Indian soldiers died in the First World War. Another, I think, more than a lakh soldiers perhaps died in the Second World War, and you recounted very vividly about some of these battles in Ypres in Belgium as well as elsewhere in the world. But in independent India, how does the Congress Party deal with the fact that these millions of Indian soldiers fought for the British colonial power?
Well, look, I mean, the fact is that Mahatma Gandhi, no less, encouraged them to enlist, right? So Mahatma Gandhi came back from South Africa in January 1915. He supported the war and he encouraged Indian soldiers to enlist. Many of the nationalists thought really that if they served the empire in its hour of need, that India would benefit. We'd get our reward in the shape of more self-governance, and that the British would keep their promises. And the sad truth is they didn't. The British broke their word. And it's true that the soldiers were professional soldiers. They weren't fighting for Indian freedom. They were fighting for the very British Empire that was oppressing their own people back home. But in the context of a time when the whole of India
was rallying behind the British. But isn't there that?
The British raised men and money. They got supplies of food, cash, and ammunition. They taxed Indians. They got donations from the princely states. They did all of these things. They got the equivalent of something like £8 billion in today's money. And I must say that nobody in India during the war was critical of this. Oh, well, I should say nobody. But by and large, public opinion supported this, even though we were racked by high taxation to support the war. There was high inflation accompanying it. Trade was disrupted, widespread economic losses, and the notorious Spanish flu towards the end of the war were taking millions of lives in India. But the nationalists supported all this because we thought, we understood from what the British were saying that at the end of the war, we would receive our rewards in the shape of dominion status. When the war ended and the British broke their promise and instead imposed the repressive Rowlatt Act, our nationalist movement turned at that point from supporting the British in the war and so on to opposing the British repression in India. And in those circumstances, you know, public protests against the Rowlatt Act, the draconian legislation, then the Jallianwala Bagh massacre in April 1919, all of this put us in a position where obviously we turned very strongly against the British. We became Indian nationalists. Tagore, who had talked sardonically about how Indians were going to save the world in this war, returned his knighthood to the British.
Right. I can understand that, Mr. Tharoor, during the freedom movement when, you know, the Congress Party or India's nationalists are fighting for freedom. But after independence, you have a good 20 years when the 50th anniversary of the First World War is being commemorated. Now, surely the shame that was attached to sending this volunteer force, or not just sending, for, you know, Indian soldiers going under the yoke of the colonial empire, surely by then you would have understood that these are your soldiers or our soldiers, and therefore that shame should not attach to us anymore.
Well, in 1964, I must say the general feeling seemed to be that India, which is only at that point, don't forget, 17 years independent by then, we were ashamed of our soldiers' participation in the colonial war. We saw nothing to celebrate. But the fact is that, I think because the war was not for India's freedom, it was not actually for an Indian cause. And because British perfidy had given such a sour ending to the narrative of a war in which India had given so much support and been spurned in return, Indian nationalists felt that the country had nothing to thank the soldiers for. They'd merely gone abroad to serve their foreign master. So that was the attitude. I'm not supporting that attitude. I actually think it was wrong, but that's how many people felt. Now, I have to say that what was interesting was that in that process, we overlooked a number of things, not only the heroism of the soldiers, but the fact that they had carried the spirit of India in these wars. They had carried the spirit to foreigners. Mm-hmm. And finally, you saw, for example, an interest in what exactly happened. You know, we've been going out in my days at the UN as great peacekeepers. Mm-hmm. And suddenly there was a recollection that Indian soldiers had been abroad before. Mm-hmm. Remarkable photographs have been unearthed of Indian soldiers in Europe and the Middle East, which you can see online. Your listeners can find them online. Yeah. And I find it impossible not to be moved. You know, these young men, visibly alien to their surroundings, about to head off for battle, some deeply injured and terrible wounds. And at the same time, what kind of spirit were there? I mean, my favorite picture of the whole war is of a bearded and turbaned Indian soldier on horseback in Iraq, Mesopotamia, in 1918. And he is leaning over in the saddle to give his rations to a starving local peasant girl.
Right.
Now, that's exactly the spirit of compassion that I have seen in Indian forces in United Nations operations, whether in Lebanon or Somalia or Yugoslavia elsewhere. And I think, gosh, that is the ethos that Indian soldiers have brought to soldiering, whether at home or abroad. We've taken that spirit around the world. How can we not honor and celebrate that?
Right.
And I think that colonial era resentments are fading, Jyoti. I mean, the resentment that people felt about the British Empire in 64, surely we don't feel, our generation and indeed successive generations don't feel it quite the same degree. We have intellectual and shall we say, policy disagreements with colonialism. But the soldiers of World War One, we see them as human beings. We can see them that way.
But yet, Mr. Karur, my question is that, you know, the government led by Prime Minister Nehru felt these embarrassments and these resentments. But perhaps today, Prime Minister Modi is feeling exactly the same emotion. So there isn't much to differentiate between Mr. Nehru and Mr. Modi. On this question, please.
Well, ask the soldiers is what I would say, and ask the descendants of those who actually went and suffered and did everything that we are now either honoring or not. I mean, there is no question that the Indian soldiers who died in the First World War didn't die for Indian soil. They didn't die to defend Indian territory, and they didn't die, they didn't die to win India's freedom. Had their sacrifices led to a degree of freedom, they would have been celebrated. And I must say that we who rightly remember the repression and racism of imperialism, we perhaps tend to think that any soldier who served that cause served an unworthy cause. Mm-hmm. But my answer to that is they were men who did their duty as they saw it, and they were Indians. Why can't we rehabilitate them for us? They're now part of our history. It's like, you know, are we now... Let's say
we are rehabilitating them, but we are the Prime Minister, the BJP government is rehabilitating them, and in fact, better than anybody's done. But there is a national war memorial.
There's no reason why we can't appreciate both. We appreciate more those who fought for us in Bangladesh, fought for us in Kargil, fought for us in Kashmir, fought for us in Sri Lanka, and even those who went out in independent India's contribution to peacekeeping operations and died in Korea or Congo or whatever. All of that, I think we are right to honor. But at the same time, we don't need to dismiss their ancestors, as it were, who died in other foreign wars. And I think we should have kept both going.
How do you look at the Anglo-Afghan War Memorial at Teen Murti, which is, you know, just a couple of kilometers away from India Gate, now renamed the Haifa Memorial when the former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu came visiting? How do you look at that? And, you know, especially in contrast with the whole colonial controversy over India Gate.
Well, I mean, the fact is that because we were ruled by colonial countries, we did go on these colonial expeditions. You mentioned Haifa. It was a battle that our soldiers fought in what's today Israel. In those days was Palestine. If you go to Jerusalem, as I have, and see the war memorial there with the names of the Indian soldiers who died, it's terribly moving. I mean, as an Indian standing in the soil of Jerusalem and looking at these names, Hindu, Muslim, Sikh names, of people who had gone halfway across the world to die in a foreign country, how can you as an Indian not be moved? They're your people and they lost their lives. So to my mind, Jyoti, I don't want to differentiate. I differentiate politically. I don't differentiate in terms of the human feelings that I have for them and that I believe all Indians ideally should have for fellow Indians who've died in whatever cause.
In that sense, both Prime Minister Nehru and Prime Minister Modi should not be embarrassed or ashamed about the contributions of our Indian soldiers in the wars that were fought, whether under a colonial yoke or not.
That's right. And in fact, how can we be? Today we celebrate our diaspora, but many of the diaspora is in those foreign countries because they went there during colonialism. You can't just wipe out the slate. We are constantly reminded of the fact that we are everywhere, that Indians, you know, had an Indian prime minister in Trinidad and Tobago and an Indian prime minister, a president in Guyana, and all of these things. And we say, wow, that's great. How did their ancestors get there? We didn't send them now as NRIs, you know, with IIT degrees. They went as descendants of often coolie laborers and people transplanted and transported by the British. Colonial history is part of what has made us who we are. And I think we really have to face it whole and square and not bring the prejudices of the past to bear on people who are ultimately linked to us by one simple, inescapable fact that they are Indian.
So a couple of last questions, Mr. Tharoor. You talked about how Indian soldiers fought on the side of democracy, both in the First and the Second World Wars. But we also have a contested history around that, and I'm talking about Subhash Chandra Bose, who is being rightfully feted by the Modi government and as well as by the people of India during his 125th birth anniversary. Now, there will be a statue of Bose installed under the Chhatri in the India Gate Central Vista, and we know that under the Chhatri was once King George V. Now, that has its own irony, but that's not a question I'm going to ask. The question is that if Bose, you're talking about a contested history, but if Bose sought the help of the Japanese and the Germans, Hitler at the time, to fight the British under which yoke India was, and today his memory is being resurrected, how do you look at that?
I'm a great admirer of Netaji for all sorts of reasons, Jyoti. One is the fact that he really was an extraordinarily courageous figure. I think, you know, we might not have been the happiest people on earth if the Japanese had actually succeeded and if the Germans had succeeded, because frankly, neither was particularly inclined to respect and honor Indians. And I think that Netaji might have found it very tough to assert himself against him. He might well have ended up clashing with them if he came in, because he would have stood up with pride for the rights of Indians, and he would have argued that we'd fought for our own freedom, our own soldiers had fought. But the other things that I admire Netaji for are the incredible spirit of secularism and commitment to equality that motivated his life. You see this in the Azad Hind Fauj, the Indian National Army, where he absolutely had people of every faith and who were close to him, who were given positions of authority and trust and who honored and loved him, Muslims, Sikhs, Hindus, Christians, side by side. In fact, the INA Memorial in Singapore is by a Christian. The man who was on the plane with him when it crashed was a Muslim. The man who came up with Jai Hind, the slogan, was a Muslim, etc. I mean, you had this extraordinary closeness to all. And what is equally striking was he was one of the first Indian leaders to honor the equality of women. In the INA, there was a women's brigade.
No, but the question on Netaji.
I'm saying these values, it seems to me somewhat ironic that the present Hindutva movement and the BJP government, which is anything but secular, which is busy disparaging our minorities and particularly our Muslim population, that this government has chosen to honor Netaji, because I've seen exactly the same thing with Gandhiji.
But that's they're a good like thing, isn't it?
They like the symbolism of a figure without the substance of what he stood for. Gandhiji gave his life for Hindu-Muslim unity, and they honor him by putting his glasses on the Swachh Bharat Abhiyan. Netaji fought for a united, undivided India. He would have definitely come back and fought against Jinnah and partition. Netaji today is being honored as a symbol of heroic resistance, which he was, while everything else that he stood for is being deliberately forgotten so that he can be a symbol of what the BJP government wants to honor and not of everything that he respected. No, these are all things that we have to face.
No, but the point is, Mr. Tharoor, that's the fact. The fact of the matter is that the BJP government or Prime Minister Modi's government is honoring Netaji because he has been eclipsed these past 70 years on a lot of occasions. Perhaps we should have honored him more. And, you know, now what is more is a question, but the fact that the Prime Minister Modi's government is honoring him, putting his statue on the Central Vista, that in itself is acknowledgement that he stood for all these values, both of secularism and Hindu-Muslim unity and the other.
Well, let's certainly remind the government and the nation that that's what he stood for, because the government at the moment in its statements has only talked about Parikrama Divas. It's all about his being a valiant hero, which he was, and a figure of great courage, which he was, but nothing else of what he stood for is being talked about. Just as, you know, as I said, they've treated Gandhiji that way. They've tried to resurrect Bhagat Singh, who was actually a communist, without referring to his ideology at all. I mean, they're very, very good at appropriating people. Sardar Patel, who banned the RSS, has suddenly become a hero of the BJP. I mean, I find this quite ironic in many, many ways. But in the case of Netaji, let me point out that well before 2014, Netaji was honored in multiple ways throughout the country. I spent my high school years in Calcutta, where the biggest main thoroughfare was called Netaji Subhash Chandra Bose Road, where the biggest stadium is Netaji Stadium. There are, I believe, 164 institutions around the country named for Netaji before 2014. So let us not act as if the Congress somehow disregarded him altogether. We were all taught about his heroic life and death. And the truth is that we all knew about Netaji before the BJP suddenly sort of came and discovered him.
No, but I think we ought to be... Right. I think the point being that, you know...
balanced about it.
I think the short point being that Netaji, like a lot of other Indian leaders, was perhaps not memorialized enough, unlike the Nehru-Gandhi dynasty. Now, I'm not saying that Prime Minister Nehru, of course, was a great man and built the republic, but perhaps leaders like Netaji should also have been memorialized, and perhaps you forgot them, like Sardar Patel.
I would honestly say it had more to do with longevity than anything else. Whether Netaji or Patel, Netaji disappeared from the Indian public life in 45, and Sardar Patel died in 1950. If they had lived as Nehruji did till 1964, I'm sure that there'd be far more institutions and statues and everything else honoring them both. As it is, I don't think any one of us has been allowed to forget them. We've all known and honored them. But you could argue that the BJP government, in order to prove a political point, has rubbed the noses of others into the fact that these people didn't get as much honor as they're prepared to give them. So fine. I mean, let that be. But let's also remember what they stood for in substantive terms, the values, ideals, principles that they represented, and let's not reduce them just to symbols, tokens, to serve a transient political purpose.
And absolutely. You
know, one day the BJP government will also be history, but the values that these historical figures stood for should not be allowed to be forgotten.
I'm also going to end by saying that Gandhiji's favorite hymn, Abide With Me, is no longer going to be part of the Beating the Retreat. It's going to be replaced by "Ae Mere Watan Ke Logo," which has been sung by Lata Mangeshkar, as we know, in the 62 book. Very movingly sung by her. Your last...
Very movingly sung by Nehruji, famously, had tears rolling down his eyes when he heard it sung. The sad truth, however, is that you won't be hearing it sung at the beating of the retreat. It's just the instrumental version that is going to be played. So that's the way that's going to be. Look, I think that erasing the past never works, and doing it for the sake of scoring political points, to my mind, is unworthy of a great country like India. We should be the kind of large-hearted nation that embraces the world. That's what Gandhiji, because Gandhiji, by the way, who included a bite with me in his morning bhajans. He used to have a repertoire of selected favorite songs like Raghupati Raghava Raja Ram and so on, and Abhayudhi was one of them. That showed the ecumenical spirit that the Indian nationalist movement was all about. But what do these people know of nationalism? They were not actually even a part of the nationalist struggle at any stage, and they're heirs to a tradition that refused to participate in the nationalist movement. No wonder they don't value any of its legacies.
On this note, Mr. Shashi Tharoor, remembering both Abide With Me and Raghupati Raghava Raja Ram, thank you so much for speaking to The Print, as always.
Thanks, Jyoti. Jai Hind.